trying to retain staff, to increase skill level, just in general get people to take the industry seriously in a way that meant that they could build a career, was just every year seemingly getting harder and harder. And so it's a sigh of relief for me to not really have to invest a lot of energy into that anymore.
This week on Dirty Linen, we continue to look at hospitality businesses that have flipped things around, changed the situation, worked with the COVID curveballs to find some silver linings. And today's guest is someone who I love talking to and I love eating her food. Jenna Abruzzese is the chef and co-owner of Kitchenette in Hawthorne. I think, is, you know, in terms of coaxing flavor from food and just finding the sweet spot and the points of magic, I think Jenna is just an absolute gun. Welcome to Dirty Linen, Jenna.
Good afternoon.
So you and your partner Megan went into the pandemic with a cafe, and you've come out the other side. Well, let's hope we're out somewhere anyway.
Yes,
the other side.
Somewhat.
But you've come out with something that's quite different. I'd love to hear more about your story.
Yeah, so we have a tiny little shop that seats 20. I guess it's pretty common now, like. 10 years ago they were the holes in the wall, but now it's pretty standard. And so we were a dine-in cafe, like, you know, super Melbourne style. And obviously sitting very close together is no longer acceptable. And we sort of just thought, how are we going to do this long term? Let's research other countries where we've had this sort of thing before, and see what happened to the economy and how businesses dealt with that, to get a bit of inspiration for making decisions, because I'm an insane planner. There's no way I could just fly by the seat of my pants through this. Like, I needed a solid plan, something that we could, you know, work on and develop to continue through and come out the other end, because we just thought there's no way this is ever going to go back, you know, to the way it was before. So now we have a fine food store.
And I have so many feelings about this, because Kitchenette is such a, as you say, it's a little place, but it was so nice to sit there and watch you in your kitchen. You really felt like you were in the thick of it. It was, everything was just right there. And it was a real, I guess, to me, it felt like a place where you could really take a slice out of your day and just be in this other moment. So as a customer, you know, I just feel a little bit sad, but.
You and the rest of Hawthorne.
Okay, so I don't want to add to that grief, but tell me a bit more about it. Like, what is it that you're offering your community now?
Yeah, so we just slowly, we had a vision, but we knew we couldn't do it drastically. We had to slowly evolve, and that was, I think it was good, because, you know, we had to switch from serving a full a la carte menu with a little bit of take home on the side, so like soups and bolognese sauce, pretty standard, but, you know, totally cutting off a la carte in one day was not really, we needed to take them with us and get them on board, our regulars and our core customers, to really understand that we don't have an option here. This is not what we would choose to do. And I really felt for Megan too, because that's her thing. Like, you know, sure, I can cook all the food, but, you know, the big, you know, 50% of Kitchenette is Megan and 50% of Kitchenette is service. And that's why, you know, chicken soup is chicken soup, but it's not when Megan serves you. So I felt like it was devastating, actually, like knowing that we'd never serve people like that again. But at the same time, it was this opportunity to tweak the business in a way that we would never have had before. So, yeah, slowly working out what the customers wanted from us and then being very flexible, you know, lockdown one, lockdown two, Christmas, 5-day lockdown, all these things have influenced the offering. And so, and obviously the seasons and availability. And so many things playing into that, but being able to present it in a way that the customer is just feeling the same way as they did when they dined in. They feel looked after, comfortable, listened to, like their needs are being met, like they're being nurtured. They don't want to hear, oh, we can't get this for you. And they don't want to hear, they wanted an escape from the awful, you know, pandemic, really. Like, so we tried to be that, you know, that that steady sort of sanctuary.
That's so interesting that you've attempted to create that same feeling of warmth even without that sit-down experience. And, yeah, I will just say for people who haven't been to Kitchenette, Megan is an incredibly warm presence. You definitely feel like you're, in the bosom of hospitality. It's just a very it's a very safe place. And I suppose that is, you know, part of feeling like you can take a slice out of your day and just, you know, forget your cares and just dive into an omelette or a bowl of soup or whatever it was, yeah, exactly as you say, it was the energy that Megan brings to the business. So, okay, I'm slowly getting over my grief about this, although it's interesting to hear that you guys felt it as a big loss as well.
Yeah. We're over it now. Like, you've processed it, but like lately there's a few people, like 99% of our customers are beautiful beings, and then there's this 1%, like everyone who has their own business that they work in every day, there's always a few rotten, you know, eggs or bad apples. And I just feel like you can't dine in anymore, we're sorry, we can't have you sitting close together anymore, it's not financially viable. Like, there's different narratives, different stories for different different types of customers, but there's been a few that are quite rude, and I just feel like that is something that's the only negative thing I think to take away from it. We've grown as individuals, as business partners. I've grown in my relationship. Like, there's so many positives, but it's just those little, they compound after a while. And sometimes you're just like, okay, we need to have a little bit of what am I trying to say? Like, Megan and I will be like, oh my God, you know, I can't take one more day of these people, but then you sort of get over it and you're like, okay, they're just, everyone is just a bit on edge, you know, they're at the end of their tether. So we're just trying to flip it back to, what do they need? What do these people need? Everyone is trying to, like, they're on the wheel. Like, everyone's back on the, you know, working like mad again. You know, life is seemingly back to normal, but it's really not. And not everyone has the capacity now, like, anymore, to go back to the levels that we were before, like that level of work, that output. I think everyone is a bit more fragile, a bit less tolerant, and so we're trying to just flip it and view it as our opportunity to tap into that and make them feel like they're being taken care of, because that's like what people crave. Like, everyone just wants community and to be connected and to be able to just slow down a bit. And like the start of COVID, like, now everyone's like, oh, it's so, you know, life's crazy again. And so I think Kitchenette is, you know, the familiarity of the dishes and that the old school approach to putting things together, the menus for the Friday night dinner boxes, and all of that is just, it's all just what is going to make you feel loved, really. Like, I mean, I know it sounds cliche, but that's what's at the core of it.
That's the energy that you're putting into it. So just let me check, I understand, Jenna, is, you know, you're saying everyone's been a bit worn down by everything that we've gone through. So is what you're doing, is part of it sort of looking after yourselves and your own wear and tear, right? And
yeah, we don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to do anything drastic. Like, I think from the outside, Kitchenette is seemingly quite rigid. You know, we're Monday to Friday, we're 8 to 3, kitchen closes at 2. Like, we've got these quite strict rules, but that's because what we do offer is so we really listen to what the people want and then give it to them. So, some, you know, one week it'll be like, you know, you see the waves through the pandemic. Everyone was crazy for lasagna, and then everyone was crazy for this, and everyone was crazy for that. So it's like the customers are the people paying the money. So if you're not making something that they want, well, then you're not going to have any. Like in yeah.
So what have they been telling you that they want, and what are you giving them?
Yeah, well, I feel like there was a time in the pandemic when the food was – the food the people wanted was very rich and comforting, and like the mac and cheese, and the, you know, in the middle of winter, like the slow-cooked beef in red wine, and like the delivery, like Providor started up, and everyone was excited to – have meal boxes at home, and, you know, creating restaurant dishes in their own kitchens. And then everyone was like, oh, I'm getting fat, COVID, I put on 10 kilos because of COVID. And so everyone's like, oh, I need chicken soup this week. So you sort of have to ride the wave of how everyone that you see the trends, like the trends in Melbourne or what's going on. And we don't really jump on board. We sort of just use our skills to coax, you know, them into what Kitchenette can, what Kitchenette does, which is, yeah. Does that sort of make sense? I've gone on a bit of a tangent there.
Yeah, it's like you're, it's almost like you're trying to be half a step ahead of where people are in a food sense. So you mentioned the Friday night dinner boxes. I mean, what are they, and what are some of the other things that you're offering?
It was big last year. Everyone was doing a box. But then I feel like a lot of those businesses have gone back to dine in to their original, models. And we didn't really do that. We switched to our food store model, and we fill the fridge every day and, with different meals and soups and whatnot. And then there's, the sandwiches and the salad offerings. It's all really accessible, just everyday food that that you don't have to make because we make it. But the dinner box now is because everyone is flat out back at work, and they want healthy, delicious food, but they just want to be able to pick it up, or it arrives on their doorstep Friday afternoon. Megan and I do the deliveries, and it's just like really homely, beautifully cooked, well put together food that they can either eat all of that night and make a 3-course or a 4-course dinner, or you can break it up and you can have the soup for lunch the next day, or it just suits, you know, what everyone is doing on the weekends. A lot of the customers, they have little kids and they've got heaps of activities and sports, so it suits them because they're just flat out with the kids. And then we've got older customers that don't want to, a few of the older customers don't want to go out to restaurants all the time. Like they feel more vulnerable. Like they tell us how, and that's the other thing. Megan really gets an insight into what the people are really truly feeling. Like you can read all the articles you want, but if you talk to the people, they're our people. And so we want to know what they're thinking and how they're living their lives differently. And then we sort of try and tap into that.
So I'm really getting a sense of how you create that real hospitality experience and that intimacy in this other style of service.
Yeah, there's just like the food is just like, oh, well, you know, broccoli's cheap and it's beautiful, so we'll just do that. Like it's not, it's a bit of an afterthought. It's more about, it's not that it's not important, but they're just classic flavours that all go together. It's not, it doesn't require a lot of thought, like planning the actual dishes. It's about how to put it together and what people, like, you know, before the budget comes out, people were seemingly hesitant to spend money. So it was a bit more of a beef and mushroom pies with mash and like a watercress salad with, and then a chicken soup, you know, for the next day. Or like it was a bit more cheap and cheerful. And then seemingly people are like, oh, awesome, budget's out. And then the $100 box comes back because everyone is, you know, they've planned their, seemingly planned out their finances a bit more. And I mean, it's Hawthorne too. It's not like, like we understand the demographic. Everyone is pretty tuned into what's happening politically. And so I think that's also, yeah, a lot of things sort of play into what we're offering and what we're pushing.
Mm. So for people who don't live in Melbourne or know much about Hawthorne, it's a eastern suburb. It's reasonably wealthy. There's a lot of families, a lot of private schools, a lot of older people as well. Do you feel like are these your people I'm talking about, Jenna, or do you want to add to that demographic?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So when Kitchenette opened, we were 7 days and it was a very brunch, expensive brunch. Demographic was late 20s, early 30s, high disposable income. Then those people, oh, and retirees, so they would be like the midweek. They would come for morning tea or after golf or that sort of vibe. But then those younger couples started to have families. So people started to have babies. We've got customers that had no babies before when Kitchenette opened, and then we've seen them and they've just had the third baby. So you've gone from a couple having, you know, smashed avo with like Campari orange for brunch on a Saturday to mum, dad is now back at work and mum is coming to get like bolognese sauce and soup, like, you know, while she's walking the dog. And then, oh, I'm going back to work now, so I'm going to get a couple of chicken dinners and what's this Friday night box thing, because they're busy now. And so we've evolved with them and their lifestyle and how their lifestyles have evolved. And it's the same with the older customers. Yeah, it's the same sort of thing. Like they are the grandparents of the younger customers. So they're like, oh, well, you know, there's another one on the way now. So, and they'll buy things and stock up the freezer for the granddaughter that's about to have another baby, or someone's in hospital and they, you know.
It's so amazing. Like you're so threaded through this community.
Well, I do feel connected. That's, yeah, like you mentioned before about it's as much for them as it is. Like it's as much for us as it is for them, and that's true. Like we're very connected to the customers.
Yeah, you said, Jenna, at the start of this conversation that you are a real planner, and so I'm interested to hear a bit more about that. And you said you researched other places that had gone through, I guess, analogous sort of societal upheavals. What sort of research were you able to do, and what kinds of things did you learn from that?
Oh, just articles online about like China when SARS hit last time, and how, and just how locking down affects the way people behave, and just in, yeah, like I think Japan was another one that we looked at, but that once you change the way people conduct their daily lives for a period, like, you know, for more than 30 days or something like that, I can't remember exactly, it was so long ago, but there was all these little things that I was like, well, this is going to happen to us. Like, this is happening to us. So we need to just let go of this model now. We need to, like, process psychologically that this is no longer, like, it's not just no longer viable, like we can't do it, because obviously everyone was made to go takeaway only, but it's not, if we could go back to dine in, like now we can go back to dine in, but it's not financially viable. Like we used to cram people in and have them really squashed up, and, you know, and so looking at how, like, cities where everyone, where there's a, you know, a big population and there's tiny shops everywhere, and there's loads of places where it's takeaway only. So how, what do they do, you know, with lines out the street? And you see it on No Reservations when he goes to, you know, all over the world. It's not, I think just Australia sometimes, you know, we're never going to see some of the things that we see overseas here, like in those cities that have like ancient food cultures, like that are super traditional. We have this hot pot of everyone, and so we're never going to get, you know, streets and streets and streets of like the same style of cuisine. And so, yeah, it's just,
so you feel like you can sort of pluck learnings from different places, different traditions, and do what works for that space and for your community. Yeah, that's, so if there was like a magic wand waved, and let's say the magic wand was 100% vaccination, and you could, you know, theoretically people could be crammed in together.
I wouldn't, because the amount of energy it took to do it, to change, I think it would be wasted. I feel like that in itself was like starting another business. It didn't look like it from the outside, but psychologically it was. It was like writing a business plan on the run while you're working without any downtime, whilst you're trying to not get COVID. Like like I'm exhausted from that. There's no way I'll change back just because I'm too tired. But also, yeah, from a more sustainable, like a financially sustainable perspective, this is smarter, because now we're not just feeding people breakfast, morning tea and lunch and afternoon tea. We're doing dinner as well, which is sort of what we intended to do at the beginning when we wanted to try and introduce this crazy early dinner idea. I don't know if you remember that, but that was pretty insane.
Yeah, I do actually, but I vaguely remember it. So it was like, well, tell me what it was. Was it a kind of snacky early dinner with the kids kind of vibe? What was it?
Yeah, it was like that. We just thought, it's funny when you think about these things now, I think, what the hell were we thinking? But we were like 7 till 7, 7 days a week, and so the kitchen would close at 7. And we had, like, people would, obviously, like, you're getting your food at 7, but, I mean, that's crazy. That's too early. You can't run a restaurant like that. But but I love that we just thought, you know, let's just try this, because we didn't want to work all night and all day. And we eventually switched to Monday to Friday because of the area. It's so there's a lot of small businesses and it's quite commercial, and we're so small that the brunch, like, people wanted to linger longer, and that was, I was like, oh, these people want to sit here for a long time. And so, you know, you just learn to what am I trying to say?
Make the decisions that work for your business and the community.
Yeah, that's right. And not be so rigid, because, you know, I've seen people, they've shut their businesses because it, you know, wasn't going to plan, or the vision, it wasn't the vision. And I said to Megan, we're not going to be those people. If it's not working, we just fix it, like, or we change it, or we evolve. We'll evolve with the customers to make sure that we're, you know, we're meeting our own needs as much as the business needs to make money. Like, it's, that's what we're there to do.
I can't help but think, Jenna, that flexible mindset has got something to do with the way that you think about produce and the way that you relate to the seasons, which is also very responsive.
The crazy seasons.
Yeah, and I think I remember this. I'll probably get this wrong, but I feel like I remember you saying that there was some pears on the windowsill for 6 days and you were just waiting for them to get to the right point, and then you basically used them like that minute that they were exactly how you wanted them to be. Like, is that...
That's my life, Danny Valente. That's my life. I just waiting for the tomatoes, for the cauliflowers, for the eggplants, for everything, like for the lemons. And so...
Because I feel like if you're waiting for the vegetables and the fruit to speak to you, that why not also be listening to your customers with the same intent and the same responsiveness?
Well, now I yell at the customers because they're like, oh, why don't you make this week? And I'm like, well, it's just they're not ready. And I show them. I'm like, see, look here. Come in here and have a look. I can't make it yet. Oh, I didn't realize that. Oh, how long do you have to keep them for? Well, sometimes I have to keep a box of tomatoes for 14 days before we can even use them for a sandwich. And everyone thinks I'm a bit crazy, but that's how everything in the market is, unless you're using super small, you know, boutique suppliers, which, like, I just didn't grow up in the industry like that. I grew up using, you know, the big fruit and veg companies where you're ordering like boxes and boxes and boxes of cauliflowers and, you know, tomatoes, like these tiny, beautiful little farms. It's just not my, whilst they have their place. And that's fine dining, fancy stuff. I'm not fancy. I'm like, you know, basic. The whole kitchenette, the backbone of kitchenette is like onion, celery, carrots. That's it. And you'd be lucky to get, you know, those pears, you were lucky. You were lucky that day. So, yeah.
You know what? I felt lucky because that tart was ridiculous. Jenna, give us the little potted history of how you came up in the industry.
Oh, I just sort of like weaseled my way into Nikki Reimer's kitchen. Oh, actually, before that I worked for Daniel Wilson at Jacques Ramon's little, I was thinking about it before, actually. I was like, oh, if they ask about that, what am I going to say? Jacques opened this funny little bistro in Federation Square. When was that? Like 2000. And so Daniel Wilson was the head chef. And I started my apprenticeship in the Burbs in French Gully where I grew up. And at a little, like, really bogan restaurant, like it was so bad, but it was so good at the same time because the guys that owned it and that worked there had worked for some really good chefs in the industry, like Blake's and one of the guys knew Daniel. And I went to trade school with a friend of mine at trade school was at Jacques and she was on pastry. And so my head chef was like, you know what, you should just go and work at one of those restaurants because you're bored and you're really curious. And I was only 16. Like I was, yeah, I didn't even know what kaffir limes were. Like I had no clue. Like Daniel said, oh, go and get the coriander from the cool room. And I got like oregano or something. Like I had no clue. Like, I mean, my family's Italian, but you know, it's like Aussie migrants. Like it was iceberg lettuce and ragu. Like it's not like we were gourmet, you know. So yeah, so it was just a big leap from suburban cafe bar restaurant to Fed Square, like. And then yeah, I think that someone told me about Nikki and I was getting fed up with stinky boys and I was like, yeah, I'm going to go and work for a woman. Like, I was so excited. And so I just rang her up and I said, I don't know if you're hiring, but I just want to come work for you. And then I got, yeah, it was a big shock because I was, like, the only apprentice with, I think, I know there were, like, 14 chefs. This is at Langton's. That was at Langton's, yeah. Yeah, and so, and it was really shiny. It was huge. Like, it was huge. It was shiny. It was insanely formal. And, I mean, I'd done a few shifts at Jacques, but this was different. You were on show. It was like a parade of chefs every night, like, out in the kitchen is super open. Like, so for everyone that doesn't know, Ciccone's is in the space now where Langton's was on Flinders Lane. And so, yeah, and that's where I met Megan. Megan was assistant manager and I think I was 17. Yeah, and then after that, Rosa, I went and worked for Rosa and, yeah. Yeah.
And then I think when I encountered you, you were working at Rumi with Joseph Abood.
Yeah, so I worked at Rumi for a while. I went overseas and worked in big hotel in Germany, and then when I came back, I thought, oh, I better settle down and actually stick it somewhere for more than 5 minutes. So I stayed with Joseph for a while, for nearly 5 years, before we opened Kitchenette.
That's so interesting. So what do you think it is that's brought you to this place where your food is kind of brilliant and basic?
Because all of those people know how to cook. Like, oh, this is going to, I don't even know what it's going to sound like, but whatever. They know how to cook old school, like super classic French style, but then they're all really into either rustic Italian or rustic Spanish, or, you know, like really like super primitive Middle Eastern, or Daniel's Asian. And so I feel like I've had exposure to these really extreme ends of those spectrums. Like, you know, you can't, if you want to be able to cook and perfectly season food, like, then Asian food is, I'm being really blanket, but, you know, that's where it has to be: sweet, salty, sour, hot. Like, you can't not understand that. If you don't understand that, then you can't cook Asian. Like, and then Sicilian, like, you can apply that to all of the other cuisines. It's just not really talked about when we talk about Sicilian or like Lebanese or Persian. We don't talk about food like in the way we do Asian food.
So you feel like you've got all these sort of building blocks, and that,
yeah, you have a checklist. It seems clinical, but it's not. You're just like, oh, well, that, we need to add that. We need more lemon. Like, there's a woman that's written the book Add More Lemon, or Must Add Lemon. What's her name again? She is onto it. Like, no one, I can't believe it's taken this long for everyone to talk about just add lemon. Like, it's like the secret to everything.
Is there a book called Always? Oh, okay. Always Add Lemon. Is that it?
I don't know exactly, but
I feel like you're talking about salt, fat, acid, heat.
No.
Is it Daniel? Oh, yeah, Daniel Alvarez.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But
okay.
But salmon as well. Like, that book, it's the same. You can't just add salt. Like, you've got to season everything accordingly to its, you know, to when you're, each addition, like all these little things that your mentors or your teachers pass on to you. And then, you know, what's the job of the chef? To bring all of their experience together. Like, and that's the thing. And I can pinpoint, like, you know, Rosa, you know, that woman's crazy. Like, she sometimes you're like, what are you doing? Like, you can't cook like that. That's not the right way. Like, that's not, you're not following the rules. And she's like, oh, I don't care. We do what we want here. Does it taste good? Do the customers love it? Then what, you know, who cares? So, you know, and then Daniel is like, no, that's not how we do things. Like, everyone's got their personality, and their personality comes out with their cooking. And I think that's, like, all the people I've worked for have big personalities. And so you can pinpoint each, you know, each chef has what they've given me or what I've taken from them. And just put it all together.
Interesting. And in a way, it sounds like what they've given you is a confidence, or you've taken from it, is a confidence to keep things simple.
Yeah, I think that Rumi, at the core of it, Joe's food is seemingly very complex because you've got so many things going on. There's loads of spices. You need to understand about nuts and the oils and it's not just acid. There's loads of different ways to bring acid in. But if you don't understand how to work with garlic, onions, and just the vegetable, I mean, that is at the core of all of that cooking, just being able to use two or three ingredients. It's the same with Rose's food. Like, you have to be able to get the best out of two to three ingredients, or else there's not, you, it costs too much money.
Yeah. So interesting, and I love it. It just makes my mouth water talking about food like this. Jenna, we've been talking a lot about staffing on Dirty Linen over the past couple of weeks. It seems to be the thing that everybody in hospitality is talking about. I guess you've sort of minimized your need for staff, but you know, what's your philosophy around that, and what are you hearing?
I feel sad about this because I just realized, like, I haven't said anything about staff, and that it's sort of a bit of a look. We have one staff member now who is a chef that works with me, and that's awesome for me, but it's sort of sad because Megan now has no staff. But I think that making the decisions that we have has meant that we've avoided a lot of pain and stress that other people are under now. And I guess that is another reason why I wouldn't go back to the old model, because that slowly became an issue for people regardless of COVID, and trying to retain staff, to increase skill level, just in general get people to take the industry sort of seriously in a way that meant that they could build a career, was just every year seemingly getting harder and harder. And so it's a sigh of relief for me to not really have to invest a lot of energy into that anymore, which is sad on one hand, but on the other hand, it means we've got more energy for maintaining and growing the business. So it's a bit of a, yeah.
Yeah, it's like you've dodged a bullet in a way, but at the same time, I'm sure you'd be an amazing mentor for people.
Well, I feel like poor Liam, he just gets bombarded with all my craziness. But yeah, I do miss the days of having like a team, a brigade. It's quite, sometimes it can be lonely, isolating. Like, it's, yeah, there are pros and cons. There's people are super stressed out by lots of the issues that come with having a big restaurant, with having to maintain, you know, huge rosters, and but also there's those beautiful moments that you have in restaurants, like service, for example. I don't have a proper service anymore, and there's all these little things that have slowly been taken away from our model, that like there's nothing really that resembles what I, you know, thrived on as an apprentice or a young chef, that apart from the cooking, the team and the adrenaline rush that you get from a service Friday, Saturday night. But at the same time, I don't know, I feel healthier in my mind, and we now don't work nights, and there are lots of pros as well. I mean, so you've got to take the pros with the cons.
Yeah, it sounds really bittersweet, but it's really, yeah. Jenna, it's been such a pleasure to chat to you and just hear more about how you're nurturing your community and yourselves. I mean, congratulations for the way that you've changed your business. There are sad elements to it, and I can tell that you feel those very much as well, but there are so many positives. So, yeah, well done. And, keep an eye on those pears.
I gave one to Megan this afternoon. It was going rogue.
Thanks for the chat.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
This is Dirty Linen, and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about. We spend a week thrashing around each issue, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta at Dirty Linen Podcast. We can't wait to hear from you.
This is a Deep in the Weeds production.
That's not my dog.
It's my dog. Don't worry. Keep going.
I was really worried that it would be my dog.
No, sorry.